From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Effin Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
You need a lot of sustenance to play a five-hour opera, but they have rules about what they can eat in a situation like this. They can't be too full. They can't be too heavy. They can't need to go to the bathroom.
I'll pay a visit to the snack table backstage at the LA Opera. Jonathan Gold takes us to Roy Choi's new place, Chego.
It basically tastes like an entire 20-course Korean dinner condensed into one bowl.
But first, let's see what's in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. Some of us are passionately devoted to the Persian mulberry, and we wait for its return. But I'm here to say that we've got a person here today who will stand on the delicious taste of a Pakistani mulberry. Now, those are the ones you're seeing in the market right now. It's a long, skinny mulberry, and Sasan from Sauce on Hampton is going to tell us what he does with the Pakistani mulberry to make it fabulous.
Well, I love the Pakistani mulberry because of its flavor as well as its texture. It has a really nice shape and length to it. The Persian mulberries are absolutely incredible, and I, as well as my mother, wait for them longingly every single year. The Pakistanis are a good holdover, as you mentioned. One of the things I like to do with them, slowly poach them in just a little bit of butter, add a little bit of fresh lemon juice because they don't have the same tartness that the Persian mulberries can have, and just poach it literally maybe 5 or 6 minutes, top it on top of some fresh vanilla bean ice cream, and just keep it really simple.
Now, what do you do with that long stem that goes all the way down the middle?
Usually, we'll cut off the top quarter of it or so, and you end up wasting a little bit of the fruit. Depending on the length of it, maybe even cut the fruit in half so that you can easily chew through it and it doesn't become an issue.
Okay, and so does the flavor transform when it gets cooked?
A little bit. Uh-huh. You lose a few of the nuanced flavors that come with the mulberry. One of the reasons why I love it raw is because you get to taste a little bit of that overripe sensation that is only coming with fruits that have such a short shelf life and have such a fleeting time at the market. And the way they look, they're just so gorgeous and bright and orange and red. They almost scream, "Eat me," when mm-hmm. you look at them.
Was it something you were familiar with before, or is it just something you found here at the market?
The main way that I've been familiar with mulberries growing up, Persian, is the dried version, in that they're almost always around dried to eat with dried roasted garbanzo beans. Mm. And because they grow in such a huge amount and they're only ripe for a very short period of time, you'll always find them dried in Iran, specifically the dried white mulberries. They have a really incredible texture to them. Mm. And that's how I was familiar with them. And then when the season started, I came with my mother to the farmer's market a number of years ago, and her eyes lit up, and she was nearly knocked back because she hadn't seen them for about 30 years or so. So to be able to get that reaction from a number of my family, as well as being able to show it to people that have never experienced it before, it's really, really a special fruit.
Great to have you here, and love the inspiration. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's Sasan, and he's the owner chef at Sauce on Hampton, which is an adorable neighborhood restaurant on what is actually 2nd Street. It's called Hampton at that point, just north of Rose in Venice. Speaking of seasonality, one of the most anticipated things at the market is the wild mushroom seasons as they progress. And we are so excited now that the porcini mushrooms are now available through Clearwater Farm, David West. So, David, tell us about the porcini, describe what it looks like, and then tell us where they're grown and just how special they are.
The fresh porcini season has been ongoing for a couple of weeks in the sense that I've had dribs and drabs. And some of my customers may know that. Most probably think I just never have them. This week, warm weather came on up north and everything came on at once. Porcini mushrooms typically grow right as the snow melts, so we have a really protracted season. There's not a lot of moisture actually in the snow this year. It's kind of an odd thing. There's a lot of snow, but it's very light, so it's melting rather quickly. So last week I had almost none. This week I'm loaded with them. I fear 2 weeks from now we'll be back to none. It's going to be fast and furious. It's a season people ask me all year, do you ever have fresh porcini? So the answer is always May and June. This year it's going to just be June because we just started, and it's going to be over before it begins. It's a big brownish red mushroom on top. Can be anywhere really, from very light tan looking almost like underbaked bread to a dark, dark red looking like raw meat almost. Mm-hmm. Beautiful, earthy, piney, sweet aroma. The flavor is not earthy and dark and brooding the way like morels are. Like, I wouldn't do a demi-glace with porcinis. either grill them in big giant chunks with just a little bit of garlic oil brushed on them and salt and pepper, or slice them wafer thin, saute them on low heat, and just serve them over toasted French bread or alongside of anything. The biggest problem I have with porcini is I eat literally half of them out of the pan while I'm cooking. And several of my customers always nod knowingly because they do the same. They're just, the aroma that comes off them is fantastic, and they're just so good.
So now what about the green, what we call the caviar, underneath?
It's the spore mass of the mushroom. And when they're very young, like the ones I talk about eating raw, it's almost indiscernible. It looks like it's about as thick as a line of mascara would be, and it's very white. It will elongate to almost an inch long and turn this dark lime green sort of. And that's the mushroom dropping its spores. They don't have gills, porcinis. It's got a different sort of spore mass underneath it, like a sponge. And as they drop their spores, which is what they do in nature, so that next year there'll be mushrooms, that elongates and it gets soft and it gets very fragrant. And when you cook it up, many people have described this as vegetarian foie gras. It's so rich.
Do you cook that spore mass with the rest of the porcini, or do you shave it off and cook it separate?
You know, it tends to fall off. I won't purposely take it off, but I do end up sometimes with piles of it because it separates from the body of the mushroom. That's nature, and that's what it's supposed to do. If it's intact, I leave it intact. But once you start to cook it, you'll see it comes off. In Italy, back around 15 years ago in Liguria, I ordered a porcini pasta. And when it came, I thought they got my order wrong. I thought they had given me pesto because there was no visible mushrooms anywhere in it. And the whole thing was green and this big, like, mucky green paste. And I'm like, I don't know what this is. And I took one bite and it was like, here we are 15 years later. I'm still talking about it. I've never been able to replicate it because I've just never had that big a supply of just the green stuff.
Thank you so much, David. You sure painted a great picture there for the porcinis. That was David West, and he's the owner of Clearwater Farm. He harvests wild mushrooms through pickers in the California National Forests. And the porcinis are in. They'll be in for a month, and definitely treat yourself to at least one. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Recipes from the Market Report are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Find a picture of the Pakistani mulberry there, too. Also, we shoot video at the market. You can watch them on our app for the iPhone or iPod Touch. And you can find them online at kcrw.com/goodfood. They're on the right side of the page. Have you heard of zero waste? It's a concept that emphasizes the reuse or recycling of all packaging materials. The goal, of course, is less trash being sent to landfills. One way to embrace zero waste is with compostable disposables. Jennifer Sines is a brand manager for SunChips, which recently unveiled a compostable bag. SunChips, of course, is part of the Frito-Lay brand.
So our new SunChips compostable bag is made out of PLA, which is polylactic acid. That is a plant-based plastic that's made really from starchy plants. Could be things like corn or potatoes or any of those starchy plants.
Should the bag be composted then?
That is certainly our goal, is that as many bags as possible would be composted. Essentially, what the technology behind the bag will do is when placed in a hot, active compost environment, it will break down and return back to the earth in about 14 weeks.
So for people who don't have an active compost pile in their home, what would be an alternative for them?
Some people have access to composting programs in their community, so we would encourage them to speak to their community and make sure that they would be accepting of this package. We would also encourage them to maybe adopt composting in their backyard. It's actually a fairly straightforward process once you learn about it, and it has some tremendous positive impacts on our environment. But even if they don't have one of those opportunities from a disposal standpoint, just throwing away our bag in your garbage and in kind of the traditional fashion is still a positive impact on the environment, because our package is made with these plant-based materials and renewable materials. We're less reliant on fossil fuels in the creation of the bag, so we're still able to have a positive impact regardless of how you're able to then finally dispose of the product at the end.
You know, a lot of us here in Los Angeles have these green bins, which accept not only waste from the garden, but also food waste.
Yes.
So we called our sanitation department and asked if they would accept the bags. And they said no. So we were wondering if you have plans to work with local municipalities to educate them about the compostability about the bag.
That's a great question. We're actually in the process of taking those steps, and we've worked with some fairly leading municipalities, places like Cedar Grove in California, Northern California, to really do some trials and illustrate for some of the other municipalities how our bag truly does perform in those environmental conditions. And we're also partnering with an organization called Earth 911 to do outreach with municipalities to really educate them again on how our bag will break down and not to be afraid to necessarily accept our bag, that the technology really does hold true to the claims that we make around degradation.
Do you get any questions from consumers wondering what to do with it?
We get all types of questions from consumers, and certainly we've taken an opportunity as people call in and ask about composting to spend a bit of time educating them on what that might be, and we've created a great resource on our website to also give people a little bit of a lesson in how they might adopt composting and that behavior.
Do you think Frito-Lay will start investigating using this type of bioplastic on other snack products?
I know Frito-Lay as a company is very interested in ways that we can improve upon our environmental footprint and ways that we can improve our packaging. And we're certainly looking for new solutions in the marketplace that address packaging and address our use of resources.
As I mentioned to Jennifer, I wanted to find out what exactly we should be doing with the so-called compostable SunChips bag. Green bin, blue bin, or black bin? So I called up Karen Higgins. She's the manager of LA City Facilities Recycling Program for the Bureau of Sanitation. I asked her what we should do with these disposables made from bioplastics.
Unfortunately, in the city of LA, our program doesn't accept those materials. They do not readily compost for the most part, and they would be pulled out at the facility before they actually got into the compost pile because it would be considered debris or trash.
Now, is the problem in that it takes a different amount of time to break down than the green waste?
That's one of the issues. Most of the items, if they broke down within a couple of months, that might be acceptable, but a lot of them do not. And so, as a rule, we don't take any of them. Unfortunately, they have to go into the trash bin.
So what is happening with this whole issue of bioplastics? A lot of people think that it's an eventual solution to our enormous consumption of plastic products. But if there's nothing we can do with them at the end part of the cycle, then it's sort of frustrating.
At some point, they may be compostable. At this point, they're not readily recognizable. So if a cup that was compostable showed up at a facility, then they process tons of materials per year. It's not readily recognizable as a compostable cup. They would think it's a regular plastic cup because they look very much alike, and they would pull it out and treat it as trash. That's part of the problem. If everything looked the same and it was readily compostable, or there was some kind of major identifying mark on the item, then that it could be more possible. But right now, it's impossible to tell.
And that's one of the issues, is that you don't keep all your things and process it here. It's sold to other vendors, right?
We have two vendors, and then we have city facilities that handle the materials. So some of the materials are mulched if they're strictly green from maybe city operations, and some of the things have to be composted because there's mixed items in it. And we do accept food scraps, vegetables, fruit in our compost bin, so those items can be put into the compost bin.
Which a lot of people didn't realize. So even if you don't have a compost pile yourself in your backyard, you can still compost through the city.
Right. Indirectly in your green bin, you can put all the regular green items, grass, you know, weeds even, but you can put fruits and vegetables and fruit scraps. you know, if you peel an orange or if you cut up something and there's the rest of the material left, you can put all of that in your green bin. That's no problem.
Yeah, I do that. I have a big bin that I keep right by my sink. And as I'm cooking, I put all my green waste into it. And then every couple of days, I go out and throw it in the green bin.
Right. It's pretty easy. I do that myself. So we try to make it simple. Unfortunately, we will not take the compostable, the items that are labeled compostable in the green bin. It would just be taken out and put into the trash. So we'd prefer at this time that people just put it directly into the black bin. And also the other issue is it shouldn't go into the blue recycling bin because it's not readily recyclable either. And at some point it could contaminate the plastic load out of the recyclables. So unfortunately, any product labeled compostables in the city of LA, we would prefer if people put it in the black bin.
It's really interesting. I understand that you're currently doing research and you're experimenting in hopes of making composting of bioplastics work better in the future. What were some of the results of your tests?
Well, a lot of the testing that I'm referring to is the staff themselves and at some of the facilities that have put the materials in just to see how long it would take. So it's more unofficial, and a lot of time, and most all of the time, they haven't broken down quickly enough. In the composting facility, it would break down faster, but it just does not break down in several months, and that's how often they turn over their loads. At the home bin, it probably won't compost at all, a lot of the products. You'll still find it months later. It may be a little wizened, bent, but it's still the basic item is left in the bin. And they are making new products, so we're hoping some of the newer products may be more readily compostable.
Well, I guess the product that everybody's talking about now is that Sun Chips bag because they're doing so much marketing about it. Is it frustrating sometimes to you at the sanitation facilities level to have something come out into the market and be thought of one way by the consumer, but you're not ready for it to really go into your stream?
That's correct. The vendors will be testing that sort of bag because it is so new. We don't know. I mean, it could take months for them to figure it out. And again, that's one bag. So out of all the materials, if that's the only bag that's readily compostable, then that means all the other brands, they have to separate them. So it's kind of difficult with the volume of materials that comes, you know, in the city of Los Angeles, we're a huge city. We have a lot of material. And for someone to pick out that one particular bag, that would also be very difficult at the level of the facility.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. It's been very interesting.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for helping spread the word. And if people have questions, they can always call 311. That's the easiest number to remember. Or they can call Sanitation, the call center, directly at 800-773-2489, and then they can ask about the compost program, the compost bins that we have for sale at a discount, the green bin, the blue bin, the black bin.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you very much.
A list of what can go in the green bin is at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, what's the difference between tasting wine and drinking it? How a wine writer manages to taste over 150 wines in one sitting. That's next. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Professional wine tasters sometimes try hundreds of wine in a single sitting. They spit, of course. How could you not? I had a chance to sit down with one of the more experienced wine writers around.
I'm Ernie Wally. I've been a wine writer for, approximately 30 years now.
So in these 30 years, you've exercised your palate like it's a little muscle, like it's sport, correct?
Entirely, yes. I believe in it's like a boxer doing skipping ropes or a footballer, say, doing press-ups to get fit. It's an athletic exercise that you need to do to train, to be fit to do the job.
How many wines are you capable of tasting now at this point in your career before they all become a muddle?
I've developed a method that enables me to taste, I don't know, maybe 160, maybe more. I don't think I've really pushed it beyond about 170.
And this is all in one session. That lasts for about how long?
Could be, say, a 2.5 hour, 3 hour session, morning session. I was recently at the Grand Jour, which is a big week-long wine tasting in Burgundy. And I looked at my watch and I looked at my tasting notes at 11 o'clock on the first morning and found I'd got through 143 wines.
Now, when you do that, how do you keep track? Do you have a system of mnemonics that you use?
Yeah, well, you have a system, not necessarily mnemonics. I've sort of invented my own notational system, which tries to get away from all this sort of aroma of blackberries and sweaty saddles and all these lovely emotive phrases that a lot of wine writers use. Because if you've got to write that 143 times, you just never get through it.
Have you developed your own numerical scale?
Yes, it's. I'm using a 20-point system of my own devising, which is a slightly varied. It's based on the Australian system, mainly because I went on a structured course. It was a potted 1-day version of the 4-day course that Australia puts its wine judges through. It taught me a lot about the sort of organisation of spatial things between aroma, flavour, appearance, and I found it a very convenient system to use. But I've also got a sort of notation with symbols, which I find handy, because if I taste two wines a year apart, I can see at a glance in which way they're different or what I liked about the last one that I didn't like about this one or whatever.
If you taste a wine 2 years apart, are you able to have a taste memory of what it tasted like the first time?
Unless it's a very exceptional wine, no.
What is an exceptional wine to you? What are some of the greatest wines you've ever tasted?
Oh, goodness. Château du Chêne 1945 has got to be in there somewhere. The 82 first growths, obviously. And I'm lucky enough to remember some of the good vintages from the 60s where... Because at the time, sort of mid-70s in England, it wasn't that much more expensive to drink exceptional wine than to drink very good wine. And now I can no longer afford exceptional wine and I have to rely on nice people from the wine trade to keep me topped up.
When you go through a tasting like you did with the Burgundies, what is the process you go through? Take us through the process of how much you put in your mouth, where does it go in your mouth, and do you spit, do you swallow?
No, I spit. I've got this large sort of U-shaped groove worn in my tongue, I imagine, over the years. Obviously, you go through what's become the traditional process. You have a look at the colour of the wine, and you can decide from that roughly approximately how old the wine is, what condition it is. You might glean a little bit of information about what the grape varieties are, if you're tasting blind. And clearly then it's up to your nose, and you want those aromas. You might want to analyse those aromas and break them down into the individual fragrances. A lot of wines open at tastings. They're opened a very short time before the tasting, and they're invariably shy. And with a lot of, even very good wines, sometimes an ordinary wine will be very upfront on the nose. And with a good wine, sometimes you don't get hardly anything on the nose. Chapoutier, who make very nice wines in the Rhone Valley, advances this theory that really good wines do have this muted nose and everything's at the back end.
Oh, how interesting. That's fascinating. After you finish a big tasting where you're really having multiple wines, what's your favorite thing to go eat to cleanse the palate, as it were?
Well, I don't know about eat. One of the things I have learned in my times in various parts of the world, you pick up things. And the Australians like this glass of beer, which they call a cleansing ale. The only trouble is it can often lead to several cleansing ales, and you forget about the initial appointment of the exercise. But that's part of it. That's a nice thing to do. As far as eating goes, I think maybe you have to eat something which will maybe blunt the edge a little bit. Cheese is always nice, very mild to medium cheese, because it does coat the palate and makes the wine taste better. There's an old saying in the business that if you're buying wine, you should buy it on apples, and if you're selling wine, you should sell it on cheese, and I think there's a lot to be said for that.
After doing what you do and spending so much of your time tasting wine, do you still have great enjoyment sitting down and drinking a bottle with friends?
Oh, absolutely love it. That's the meaning of the exercise. I mean, wine was not invented for an academic exercise for people like myself to indulge and pontificate about. It's a drink to be enjoyed with food or without, and as a social occasion. There's nothing nicer than to sit down of an evening and have a nice bottle of wine with really good friends, and hopefully some of them you can, even if they're not wine buffs, they can glimpse some idea of the quality of what you're offering them.
Are you capable of sitting down and drinking a bottle without analyzing it, just enjoying it?
Oh, totally, yeah. You've got to be able to switch off. And at the end of the day, there's tasting and there's drinking, and I think it's important to separate the two.
What a pleasure. It's been great spending time with you. Thank you so much, Ernie.
That's a pleasure. It's been wonderful. Really nice meeting you.
Ernie Wally is a wine and food writer living in Dublin. I've got a link to his blog, Fork and Cork, at kcrw.com/goodfood. He gave us the names of a few wines that he likes right now. They're on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. After tasting 150 wines, what do you think Jonathan Gold would eat? Jonathan, of course, is the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, and he joins me here nearly every week with a restaurant for us to try. This week, we're going to the neighborhood of Palms.
We're going to Chago, which is the new actual sit-down restaurant with actual walls and a door and window and everything from Roy Choi, who you may know from Kogi.
Okay, so if Roy Choi is opening a bricks and mortar place, it's because he wants to do a little more than what he's doing on the truck.
Possibly.
And they must be filled with flavor, right?
So much flavor. The basic conceit here, if you can call it a conceit, is rice bowls. Sort of like the beef bowls that we all used to get at the drive-thru counter at 2 in the morning, except with Korean flavor and with Kogi flavor. A rice bowl after a night of serious drinking is something you need. We have been talking a lot about drinking through the last few weeks, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. You're not the only one we've been having this conversation with either. It's a theme.
These are the days we live in.
Yes. So give me a few examples of some of the bowls.
Probably the marquee bowl is something they call the buttered kimchi chow.
Oh, God.
Which is buttered rice. There's tofu that's been cooked with chili. There's edamame. There's ganep, the Korean herb that's shredded and tossed around. There's garlic. There's tons of soy. There's pork rinds. And it's all in one bowl of happiness. It basically tastes like an entire 20-course Korean dinner condensed into one bowl.
But on top of buttery rice, which right. has to just, as they say, kick it up a notch.
Exactly. And there's also fried egg on top of that.
Of course. So you get that lovely, drippy fat just infused and coated.
Right.
Okay. So if we don't go for the marquee bowl.
There is something they call chubby pork belly, which is really nice, you know, braised and crisped off and coated with a gochujang, the really hot, sort of slightly smoky Korean chili paste. And it's one of the better pork belly preps in town, even if you don't have the bowl with the fried egg and the ang choy and the horseradish and the shallots and all the other stuff.
I mean, that's the thing about Roy that's pretty amazing, is he'll take a food that is just unbelievable, can stand up on its own in terms of flavor and how it's prepared, and then he makes it just one of a symphony of ingredients.
Yeah, with Roy's style is it's evolving, too much is never enough. And sometimes it doesn't work, and he seems to be able to have it happening that way. So, for example, you would have a plate of, you know, charred asparagus, charred on the grill, and you'd put it off with a little olive oil and a little salt, and it would be a really delicious dish.
I made it last night for dinner.
I don't blame you.
And what would Roy have done with it?
Well, if the words blueberry habanero salsa mean anything to you, plus garlic, plus chilies, plus I think there's cheese and bacon on it, it's a lot. And the asparagus comes through as asparagus, and you get the flavors of the char. You get that slightly sweet, slightly acrid, wonderful round asparagus and spring flavor, but you get a lot of other stuff too.
Yummy. Now, is it purely rice bowl at Jago?
They have a section of appetizers, which include, for example, that asparagus, something they call the $12 salad, which has spinach and goat cheese and pecans and pickles and cranberries and, you know, a $12 salad for $7, just like something you would get from Carl's Jr.
That's so great.
And they have meatballs and such. But they also have a list of specials which go in and out, which will include other things like grapefruit yogurt with smoked almonds or their version of chili fries that comes with sour cream and a bunch of Korean flavors going on top of it.
Now, they're only open at night right now.
They are only open at night from 6 until midnight or whenever they feel like closing.
Please tell me where it is and include the cross street if you would.
The address is 3300 Overland near Palms in Palms.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Get Chago's address and phone number sent to your phone. Just text the words good food to 69866. That's good food to 69866. It's like magic. And you can find all of Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant map. It's on our blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. The map also includes Orange County restaurant picks from the OC Weekly's Gustavo Arellano. Next, how musicians prepare to play 17 hours of opera. It's all about the snacks. Stay tuned. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I'll be back in 1 minute. This summer, the LA Opera is performing Wagner's epic Ring Cycle. The show is over 17 hours of music, played over 4 nights. My friend Kazi Patelka is a violist in the orchestra, and she invited Good Food producer Harriet Ells and I to talk with some of the musicians during a dress rehearsal. I asked Kazi how they endure such a marathon of music.
This is literally, for me, one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life as a professional violist, to play these things. They are physically grueling and mentally, I mean, the concentration, you can't let up for a second. It is really hard work, and I love it. I consider it to be a privilege to make this journey, but damn, it's hard. The musicians have to plan for this like an athlete plans for it. And they have to be very careful about their physical preparation and their food in particular. Because you need a lot of sustenance to play a 5-hour opera, along with a lot of Advil. Every time you come at intermission, you see everybody in the orchestra eating. But
they have rules about what they can eat in a situation like this. They can't be too full. They can't be too heavy. They can't need to go to the bathroom. They have to eat foods that are going to sustain them and not fill them up. My routine is that I have to practice a lot because I'm trying to juggle four really long operas at once. I have 400 pages of music that I have to keep under my fingers to do this ring. I've got to stretch. I've got to walk. And I have to bring lots of healthful things down to eat. And I always bring something for right before, something for the first intermission, something for the second intermission. And most of the people in the orchestra do that too.
My name is Flo Titmus. I'm a violinist with the Los Angeles Opera Orchestra. At a certain point, it just got to the point where I thought, we need to have snacks in here. And so Kazi and I, we both love to talk about food. So I started with the M&M container. And then every once in a while, people bake things. And so I usually make Greek things, which are from my heritage. Like today, I brought spanakopita, which is, you know, phyllo dough and spinach and cheese. And people really like that. It's savory. And then some people like sugar. So I made walnut cookies.
I'm Christine Morel, and I play the French horn. For this performance, I actually am real careful about my carbs. I only will eat the healthy ones because otherwise my energy will flag and I can't concentrate in the last hour. And I actually eat bananas, too, at the intermission. So for me, it's one banana for every 2 hours of opera. I have this kind of no science. So, for example, the last one is 5.5 hours long, so it's a 3-banana show for me.
Michelle Richards, and I'm a violinist. Right now, I haven't eaten all day. I mean, so I just have a salad or something to get me through, and I might eat some. Well, I go to the machine and get some trail mix at the break, but I usually eat a pretty healthy big meal after I get home with a martini.
Oh,
God, yeah.
My name is Steve Scharf, and I'm the associate principal second violinist. I prefer not to fill my gut with food because the blood goes to digest the food, and that takes away from the blood that goes to my brain. But on occasion in a 5-hour opera when I'm tired between the second and third acts where we've already played for 3.5 hours or more, a little coffee doesn't hurt.
How did the first act go?
Oh, it went really well. Hour and 20 minutes.
So what are you going to eat right now?
Brown rice and veggies. I got to go put it in the microwave.
We always look forward to intermissions because Flo is an incredible cook and baker, and she just makes the most amazing things. Is it hard not to overeat during intermissions? Yes, it is.
That's an understatement. We all gain a lot of weight on this job.
So, Kazi, what do you do at the end of the performance after you're done?
Well, if I were younger, I would drink more. But because I have to play another Wagner opera tomorrow, I'm more well-behaved than I might normally be after such a grueling performance. I would love to go out and have a martini, but I have to play another Wagner opera tomorrow and another one the day after that. So I have to be... I myself have to be more cautious, whereas some of my colleagues go out and party at the bar.
Backstage pictures and Flo Titmus's recipe for walnut cookies are at kcrw.com/goodfood. There's something about being in a theater and eating snacks. These days, going to the movies can mean total calorie loading. Theaters sell everything from popcorn and candy to pizza, cookies, and lattes. So is it okay to bring your own? Helena Eichlin, the etiquette expert at Chow.com, is here to set us straight.
I mean, a lot of people, I think, know this. Movies make most of their money. Their single biggest revenue stream is concessions, snacks, and drinks. And it's been that way since the, I think since the Depression, because it was during the Depression ticket sales started to fall a lot and they realized they could make a lot of money from popcorn. So they used that to boost their revenues. And then after the Second World War, they saw ticket sales fall again because of TV. And again, they started selling more snacks. And then now we're seeing lots of people are just staying home and watching DVDs. So there's even more pressure on them to make money from food and drink.
You say that you never purchase your snacks at the movie theater. You always bring your own. What do you tend to bring?
Popcorn. Because I feel like I could sit through a movie and not snack if it was other snacks. But I can't sit through a movie without popcorn because popcorn is so intrinsic to the movie-going experience. And so I'll bring my own. And I'll put it in a container that's not too noisy and crackly, like a plastic bag. It's not a good idea. Maybe some kind of stiffer, sturdier container, like a cardboard container. And then I can have whatever I like on it. It could be healthy, could be unhealthy.
I mean, when I go to the movies, I get popcorn and I get a box of Raisinets and I pour the Raisinets into the popcorn.
A friend of mine told me about that recently, that he was like, this is the best popcorn you're ever going to have. But his recommendation was Milk Duds.
I have to tell you that I once had the experience of being in a movie theater and having some guy behind me unwrap a corned beef sandwich with a pickle.
Wow.
And it was really disgusting. It was really disgusting. So where do you draw the line at what kinds of snacks you bring from home?
Well, I mean, that's a good example of what not to do because it's very smelly, like, and especially so you should avoid hot foods, which tend to be more aromatic. And then anything too noisy and crunchy.
And is there a big chance that you're going to get busted? I mean, when you bring your popcorn into the movie theater, how do you hide it?
I think you have to, I mean, there are signs posted in most movie theaters saying no outside food or drinks. At the same time, I think they're likely to turn a blind eye. And I did interview a few people who sort of admitted it without wishing to have their names published. They sort of admitted that they wouldn't make a fuss if they saw someone eating their own popcorn. Generally speaking, that is the case. So there was one incident in England a couple of years ago where a guy walked into a movie theater with a big bag full of candy, but I think he was doing it with a certain provocative swagger. And the guard asked him what was in the bag. And when he found out it was full of outside candy, he gave the guy a choice to dump the bag or leave. And the guy actually left and then staged a protest outside the movie theater with handing out, he printed up leaflets with sort of price comparison breakdowns, the price of candy at the movie theater versus the candy store across the street. And he got loads of media attention, actually. Like he struck a nerve. Like people, I think, are quite annoyed about the price of candy and popcorn. Like if movie theaters sold delicious food, you know, then it would be different. It's not just that it's unhealthy and overpriced and incidentally comes with a ton of packaging, which nowadays isn't very ecological, but it also is not delicious. Like if they sold popcorn with truffle oil or, you know, real butter at the movies, then I think people would be more willing to buy it.
I'm really curious, Helena, because I know that you did a column on this on chow.com. How did Chow Hounds go? Were they for bringing your own or opposed?
You know, I thought they would be very much for it because they are very into food. And I was sort of looking forward to the popcorn recipe recommendations they'd have. But there was some dissent. There was a sort of anti-American flavored dissent. And the gist was, first of all, if you buy a movie ticket, you're agreeing to obey the rules of that business. And second of all, why can't you just sit for 2 hours without snacking? Why do Americans, it was very sort of anti-American, it was why do Americans have to snack all the time?
Well, I agree with that, but I think the movie theater is absolutely the snacking experience.
Everybody else is snacking. It makes you want to. I can go 2 hours without snacking, just not while I'm watching a movie.
Yeah, absolutely. It's impossible. Well, thank you so much. It's interesting to think about all of this.
Thank you.
What do you like to eat at the movies? Do you think it's okay to bring your own? Leave a comment on today's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. I asked some people on Facebook what they thought. Most people think it's okay to bring your own, and they've got some really interesting suggestions. Join the conversation by becoming a fan of me, Evan Kleiman, on Facebook. Summer's here, and I'm ready for a vacation. I'll take you on a road trip to Ventura County next. You're listening to 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. We all need a break sometimes, and here in L.A., it can be as easy as driving north a few miles to the coastal town of Ventura. Allison Costa joins us as our palette to the north. I'm so excited to have a little roundup of Ventura places to eat, Allison. Tell me a little bit about just the scene up there.
Well, there's a little bit of everything in the whole Ventura County area. There's the little hole-in-the-wall taco stands, and then there's your higher-end restaurants.
Okay, so let's start. Give me some things that we might want to travel to check out, or some of the local Ventura listeners might never have seen.
Okay. Well, I was thinking, when I was thinking about coming on your show, I was thinking about how best to approach this. And I do a bit on my blog where I talk about, you know, the best thing I ate this week. So I was thinking, what are the best things I've eaten this year in the Ventura area? And one of the best things I've eaten in Ojai is the quiche at Need Baking Company. And Need is this neat little bakery. It's fairly new. I think they've been open about a year, year and a half now. A mother and her two daughters run this little bakery, and they're open for breakfast and lunch. And it's this bright, sunny little bakery. You sit there and you have your coffee and a muffin, and you feel like you're sitting in a good friend's kitchen. You kind of want to stay and linger. And they do a different quiche each day, and utilizing, of course, as much fresh produce from the farmer's market as they can. And their most popular and my most favorite is a quiche with arugula, goat cheese, and sun-dried tomatoes. And they do, first of all, their crust is made with semolina flour, and it's thick and really buttery. To me, it tastes like a savory shortbread, and it's all underneath and on the side of the quiche. And the goat cheese is really sweet and soft, and then you've got the peppery arugula and these tangy, kind of chewy sun-dried tomatoes. It's a piece of quiche that you're not really going to want to share with anybody else.
And the name of the bakery is Need, and that would be K-N-E-A-D,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, yes. And they've got incredible baked goods. They also do they do a chocolate croissant. Normally, you know, chocolate croissant just has really good chocolate in it. Well, theirs is, you know, with the chocolate hazelnut spread like Nutella, and then on top of that, you know, dark chocolate. So when you eat it and it's all melty, it's Nutella and dark chocolate inside. So everything is kind of, you know, above and beyond.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
And next?
Next, I'll talk about Ventura. First favorite thing I ate in this past year was the tomato soup at Main Course California. And in the spirit of full disclosure, I do just recently started helping out with the catering department at Main Course, but they have a little bistro. And when I first reviewed them last year, I fell in love with their tomato soup. And it's this little catering company, and then they have a bistro, and they were also becoming known for their use of fresh local ingredients and grass-fed beef and free-range chicken. And they make this tomato soup that to me just tastes like pure summertime. It's really just unadulterated tomatoes roasted with some salt, pepper, and olive oil and pureed. I think she adds a dash of sugar and a little splash of truffle oil. But what I love about the soup is every time you go in there, it looks and tastes different based on where the tomatoes came from, what time of year. It's really a bowl of soup to savor.
Wow, that sounds really good. Now I want some grilled cheese.
Yes. Exactly. They go well together. Yes. The Sidecar Restaurant is one of Ventura's higher-end restaurants, but on Tuesday nights, they do grilled cheese and jazz. The chef there, Tim Kilcoyne, it's sort of his way to support the local music scene. And on Tuesday nights, he offers kind of a scaled-down, simple, little more affordable menu. So it's a really nice way to get into a really nice restaurant, kind of in a more low-key way. So he, of course, does your traditional grilled cheese with Tillamook cheddar or white cheddar, but then he does some really, really unique grilled cheese sandwiches. And my favorite one was a leg of lamb thinly sliced with goat cheese and a Syrah reduction.
Wow.
Yes. And it's not a giant sandwich. You know, it's pressed and kind of thin, but, I mean, you just want to eat it really, really slowly. And they also do on those nights to go with your grilled cheese sandwich, blue cheese fries. So they're these crispy French fries covered in lots of melting Maytag blue cheese. And then kind of as a garnish, he puts on either fried parsley, sometimes sage. Last time I was there, it was carrot tops. So it's garnish, but it's adds this little crunchy zing. And then he makes his own homemade ketchup, which has some clove in it. So you get the salty, crunchy French fry, the tangy blue cheese, a little bit of the, I like the sage, a little bit of the sage on there when he does that, and then the kind of sweet clovey ketchup. It's really,
that
really insane. Yes.
Really good.
Yes, it really is.
That's worth a trip.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And the other place in Ventura is Spencer McKenzie's. Spencer McKenzie's is known for their fish tacos, but this is not your average taco stand. And the best thing I ate there this year was their tuna pocket. And this is this curious little thing. I've never seen anything like it. Picture half of a little pita, but it's tofu. So it's kind of stretchy and sticky. And they stuff it with sweet sushi rice and then top it with chunks of blackened ahi tuna and then drizzle it with this sauce that's like a mixture of hot sauce and a little bit of mayonnaise. So you've got this sticky rice and the spicy fish and the tangy sauce. And for me, if you order two of those, you're good to go. That's two for lunch is perfect.
Now, what about just a great burger?
Great burger. Well, if you want to go high-end burger, in Oxnard, the Tierra Sur restaurant, which is at Herzog Winery. The winery and the restaurant are both completely kosher, which makes it really, really unique. And the other thing is it's one of those wineries that's kind of in an industrial park in the middle of nowhere. So you pull up to this big building and you walk in and you're sort of instantly in this beautiful, crisp, clean restaurant and winery with these, you know, two-story high windows. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place, and you'd never know it was in there. And they make this incredible bison burger. It comes open-faced on a thick square of brioche bread, then the bison burger, and then they top that with a fried egg and lamb bacon.
Wow.
And yes. I mean, it is as amazing as it sounds. I mean, you just know it's going to blow your mind. And it does, because as you cut into it, you cut into the egg yolk kind of infiltrates everything. So you've got the buttery bread, the tender bison. And I found it very, very tender. And then the egg, which kind of gets into everything. And then the smoky bacon. And the lamb bacon, definitely, as far as bacon goes, tastes pretty, pretty gamey. So if you like that, great. The smokiness to me was really, really strong, much stronger than like your regular bacon. But it's really a neat spot. I don't think a lot of people know about it. And it's not that far off the 101, actually. So if you were coming up from L.A. for a day trip, that would be a good place to. You can just pop right off the highway. It's right there in Oxnard.
Allison Costa is a restaurant critic for the Ventura County Reporter. We'll have info on the places she mentioned at kcrw.com/goodfood. Last week, I introduced you to some really interesting California olive oils. Well, today, I'll taste some vinegar varieties. Phil Brooks is the owner with his wife, Debbie, of We Olive in Long Beach, a shop specializing in gourmet products. Phil introduced me to some flavored vinegars.
So we're going to give you the pear vinegar to start with. This is a Napa Valley product. It's just beautiful.
Wow.
We do blend this with one of our olive oils. It does make a good salad dressing. I will mention with some of our vinegars we use over ice cream. With one of the olive oils that we pair this with, it's just amazing over ice cream. It's just like candy over ice cream.
It's very floral on the back end, this one. It really lingers.
Okay. It's a cab vinegar. It's not an aged cab vinegar. I love it as a reduction. I also love this as a marinade.
Wow. It's really good. I mean, I have a real sort of pet peeve about how bad most red wine vinegars are that you get in the store because they have no age at all. Very uninteresting flavor profile. This is really delicious. The cab, even though it's not aged, the cab gives it more oomph. Okay, what's the next one, Phil?
The next one is one of my favorites. This is from Honey Red Farms. This is Washington State. I really enjoy honey, and this is 100% honey, zero sulfites. It is amazing for marinating pork, to put in with chickens. Our lemon olive oil goes fantastic with this as a dressing.
Wow, that's really yummy. That's really yummy. Like, I'm not big on sweet salad dressings, but that would make a really beautiful vinaigrette for spinach or a more assertive kind of green, maybe with some herbs in it. Okay, now here is this phenomenon of white balsamic vinegar. Tell me about who the producers are.
B.R. Cohen, as we know, do fantastic wines. Bruce Cohen, as many don't know, was the manager of the Doobie Brothers. Got himself into the wine industry, found the olive oil industry. We carry a number of olive oils, and our best-selling product of theirs, their white balsamic. Same techniques as the, you know, more traditional balsamics, the blacker balsamics. We just don't use the skin of the grape, the skin of the Trebbiano grape.
Wow, it's interesting. It's a little sweeter, but it still has nice acid. What do you like to use this for?
You know, over my salads, I will use it that. I will use it over fruit a lot more. A lot more of my fruit salads and things like that. Well, especially I don't want to discolor them, I will use this white balsamic.
You know, this would be, I think it'd be interesting to make like a straightforward French vinaigrette with this where you put Dijon mustard and shallots. I think that would be interesting because I would usually use the champagne vinegar for that. But it'd be interesting to try with this and give that hint of extra sweetness. Okay, now this last one looks like a really nice balsamic vinegar. Where's this from?
This is from Modena. This is our best-selling item in the store. It is an aged balsamic. It is from Modena. It's kind of a blend of a 10, 12, and 18-year-old balsamic. What can't you use it for? It's a salad dressing on its own.
It's a drink on its own. It's really, really delicious. Thank you so much, Phil.
Thanks again.
A list of the vinegars I tasted is at kcrw.com/goodfood. I've got some salad dressing recipes, including my famous garlicky vinaigrette there, too. To hear about California olive oils, listen to last week's show at kcrw.com/goodfood. Subscribe to the podcast at kcrw.com/goodfood. Pictures, recipes, and information on all of our guests is there, too. And sign up for our newsletter. I do book giveaways and share recipes every week. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced and edited by Harriet Ells with Bob the Swede Carlson, Connie Mama Alvarez, Jillian the Baker Ferguson, and Candace Boris Becker Moyer. Gary Macias is our music man, thanks to Ronnie El Guapo Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.